Well, good afternoon, everybody. I feel like the warm-up act to Dr. Mark Harden, actually. And so, you know, when he arrives, you'll understand, like, why I feel that way. But it's really an honor to be with you. It's always fun to visit this community and your family, your church family here. Let me give you a little background, a little more background to me and also how I came to just learn more about this topic. My wife and I'm actually from California, and my wife Ming had been here in Boston for quite some time. I decided to relocate from Golden, California, not because I'm afraid of earthquakes, but because and come out here when we got married. We got married in 1999, and part of the reason was that I wanted to understand what it was. I wanted to observe more of the black church and understand what the black church has done to engage issues of the city, of race, of inequality, because there was a time when white evangelicals left the city for the suburbs, right? And that was in the 40s and 50s, and that trend seems to be reversing. And gentrification is its own issue. We don't have time to talk about it here, but I really wanted to understand what it was like for the black church community to wrestle with these issues. And so my wife and I, we bought a house in Dorchester. We live at really close to Franklin Park at the near the intersection of Blue Hill and Talbot, which is just like 15-20 minutes away from here. We had some friend, or my wife had some friends who were part of a mostly African-American church, and so we wanted to be part of that community. It's been a real privilege for us to be part of that community. And recently, we joined a new church called Rescue Church Boston. One of the founding pastors' name is Ricky Grant, and he's a very dynamic, fun, 33-year-old, great preacher. And so just so you understand where this comes from for me, he actually we've developed our friendship really. It's been a fun friendship over the last 2 years, and he's invited me to be part of the church leadership there, which. Again, it's a great privilege because the church is 85% pan-African-American. I'm Japanese-American. I have a lot to learn, and this was one of the things. So a few years ago, year and a half ago, Ricky said he would love for as many people as possible to read Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. The reason is because this really is the kind of civil rights issue of our generation. And there was a time in which civil rights issues were carried and borne largely by the black church. And Michelle Alexander herself, I believe, is a Christian. She doesn't tout that in her book, but the basic idea of and the burden of her observations are that we have a new Jim Crow system of racial hierarchy. The old Jim Crow system was the system of racial hierarchy that set in after the Civil War, and after slavery was abolished, there was different ways of basically carrying out white supremacy and the oppression of the black community, as well as other minority communities. So I'm going to take us through some of the material and also weave that in with some biblical reflections on why is this such a problem and what resources from the standpoint of the character of God do we have in dealing with this? So what is the church's mandate for addressing this new Jim Crow system? Are you ready? Okay, so please interrupt me as we go, because this is a bit heavy. I mean, some of you may know people who have gotten into drug-related trouble or been in prison for whatever reason. I do, and so whenever I teach this material, that's weighing on my mind. In fact, a friend of ours recently got out of prison for violent crime a few years ago and just had such a struggle, despite being a totally different young man, finding a job and just finding a place in this community. So what I'm going to do here is begin with a recent admission from a few weeks ago, actually. John Ehrlichman, this was a former aide to President Richard Nixon during the 70s, and he refers to the war on drugs as a total lie. He said this: "We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black," and by that he means the Vietnam War. So the Nixon administration was having trouble with hippies and civil rights protesters, who were mostly black. So that's what he's referring to. But by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did. Of course we did. However, despite the fact that the elites, those in power, knew this was a lie, it took a long time. It's taken decades for most of us, including me, to realize just what was going on. So I want to play this YouTube video. If we could cue that, please. This is Matthew Fogg, who is a former drug enforcement agent. There's a documentary being made that features him and a bunch of others reflecting on their experience as part of law enforcement. Okay, so I'd like to play this here. In the beginning, just for the first few seconds, he refers to, as a kid, how he actually befriended some police people and was inspired to be a policeman. So, and then the rest of the video is about what his experience was.
They throw me their keys, and I would have to get in their cars, and like they park up the block, I'd have to either back up or take it around the block. Either a kid sitting in a police car. Oh man, my chest just grew about 10 inches, man, because I get in the car and I'm riding. And I started thinking this is what I want to do. I became supervisor of Group 42 for the Drug Enforcement Administration. They cross-designated me. I had to get sworn in as a special agent for DEA. So now I'm doing dual tasks. I'm a U.S. Marshal and I'm a special agent for DEA. That's when I picked up the name Batman. I'm talking about Gotham City, man. We were rolling, man. We were jumping on guys in the middle of the night, all of that, swooping down on folks all across the country. Using these sort of tactical operations that we went out on that you would use in Vietnam or using some type of war-torn zone. And all of the stuff that we were doing, just calling it the war on drugs. And it wasn't very many black guys in my position. So when I would go into the war room where we were setting up all of our drug and gun addiction task forces, determining what cities where we're going to hit, I would notice that most of the time was always appeared to be urban areas. That's when I asked the question, well, don't they sell drugs out Potomac and Springfield and places like that? Or maybe y'all think they don't. The statistics show they use more drugs out in those areas than anywhere. The special agent in charge, he says, we go out there and start messing with those folks. They know judges, they know lawyers, they know politicians. You start locking their kids up, somebody's going to jerk our chain. He said, they're going to call us on it, and before you know it, they're going to shut us down, and there goes your overtime. What I begin to see is that the drug war is totally about race. If we was locking up everybody, white and black, for doing the same drugs, they would have done the same thing they did with prohibition. They would have outlawed it. They would have said, let's stop this craziness, because you're not putting my son in jail. My daughter's not going to jail. If it was an equal enforcement opportunity operation, we wouldn't be sitting here anyway. It's all about fairness, man, and understanding how would I want to be treated. Whether I'm on that one end or the other end, how would I want to be treated if everything was done equally?
Great, thank you. The And I'm going to be upfront with you. I wrote a curriculum for our church to essentially help us read this book, because I looked at Boston Public Library and there were nowhere near enough copies of this book for everyone in our church to read it. So what I did is I summarized every chapter down to one or two pages and then coupled it with reflections on Christian restorative justice and see where that goes. And I've used this with my church, a few other churches, college students, and my pitch to you is this. I would love for you to use it. Why? Because even though there is momentum on both the left and the right to repeal the war on drugs and to make major changes in our criminal justice system, our elected officials still need to hear from us. They need to hear from you. Because without that voice, things will happen more slowly. And you may be aware that the federal prison system is 40% overcrowded. Right? So if you think of what that means for prisoners and also correctional officers, it's just horrible. It's just horrible. And so a lot of these folks are in for nonviolent offenses. And so what I'm going to do is to give you a little bit of an overview of the problem and then actually step you through in a kind of a workshop dialogue format, one of the main chapters of Michelle Alexander's book. Okay, so just some basic facts. This is about drug use. The National Household Survey on Drug Abuse reported in 2000 that white youth aged 12 through 17 are more than a third more likely to have sold illegal drugs than African American youth. Any of you surprised by that? I'm totally surprised by that, because that's not the media stereotype of who is a drug seller. Thus, the very same year, Human Rights Watch was reporting that African Americans were being arrested and imprisoned at unprecedented rates. Government data revealed that blacks were no more likely to be guilty of drug crimes than whites, and that white youth were actually the most likely of any racial or ethnic group to be guilty of illegal drug possession and sales. White youth have about three times the number of drug-related emergency room visits as their African American counterparts. Three times as many emergency room visits. So overdosing leads to hospital visits, right? So by that metric, who's using drugs really? And I've been in campus ministry for a long time, so I know that in mostly white fraternities, that there's a lot of drug use. In fact, as I walk around Harvard these days, I smell marijuana more often than I remembered smelling it about 5 years ago. So what's going on? And so when you tie that then to Matthew Fogg's testimony of where's the money, but also where's the power? Where is he trying to avoid? Who is he trying to avoid? Or at least these departments. Also, it may interest you to know that the first anti-drug laws, were directed against the Chinese. So this comes from a documentary called, I believe it's The House I Live In, and it's basically about how drug use has always been ethnically stereotyped. And so when we talk about drugs, there's always someone in mind that you picture, right? And that is something that politicians use to their advantage. So the first anti-opium laws in the 1870s were directed at Chinese immigrants. The first anti-cocaine laws in the South in the early 1900s were directed at black men. The first anti-marijuana laws in the Midwest and the Southwest in the 10s and 20s were directed at Mexican migrants and Mexican Americans. Today, Latino and especially black communities are still subject to wildly disproportionate drug enforcement and sentencing practices. So, that's interesting. And if we had more time, I would show you a little bit of this, but that's the video. So this is what it's looked like over time, from 1960 to about 2010. So you can see that this push to incarcerate more people, who that affected. Roughly speaking, It doubled or tripled. And but for black men, it more than tripled. It gone up, went up considerably. You know, prisoners went up considerably for white and Hispanic as well. But more than three times as much for black men. Now, so I want to reflect quickly on equal treatment under the law and where it comes from. So, can everyone see this? This is a comparison between the Code of Hammurabi and the Jewish law. Basically, the idea that people need to be treated equally because every person has equal dignity comes from the Bible. It comes from God. And this is just one of those places. Now, I'd like us to talk about this. What do you see the difference being between the Code of Hammurabi, which was a few hundred years before the Jewish laws traditionally been said to have given, about 1400 BC. This comes from 1800 BC, but we think they're roughly comparable. Okay, so tell me about the Code of Hammurabi.
Depends on your possession.
Yes. What depends on
your worth?
The possession. Your worth does, yes. So if I'm poor and you commit a crime against me, you could probably get off by paying paying some money. Isn't that interesting? That the punishment for your crime depends on how poor your victim is. Okay, anything else? Okay, how about the Jewish law? What do you notice here?
Any human being, so it's independent of a person's possession.
Yes, there's not even mention of a person's possessions. How wealthy or poor is the victim? It doesn't matter. Every person is important and valuable and equal. Steve, were you going to say something?
This specific provision, 22 from Stranger, for folks who aren't main people in the community, that they're going to be treated the same exact way.
Yes, yes. So they have, on this issue, they have human rights, not just citizens' rights. We don't even have that now. Okay, so when we say that, I'll just put it this way. Is the Jewish law kind of progressive in that sense? It sure seems like it. I would say this is one of the many things of why I'm still a Christian. Because the Jewish law is aware of the other laws around it, and it's debating them. It is arguing with them and saying, your laws aren't right. They're not just. And how do you, when you stand back and look at it that way, do you think that this was just authored by human beings? If everyone else thought like this, man, that's tough. So I think there's a divine mind behind this. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Because you can't explain this as a function of like, well, they're copying their neighbors, or no, they're not. They're debating their neighbors. Further, so yes, so this is really, really important. This is also important. If you go home and look that up later, basically what you'll see is that the victim has a right to name a compensation. So let's say that I'm that you own a store and that I steal from you, right? And a half an hour later, I bring back that whatever. And I say, you know what, I'm really sorry, I had a change of heart, and here you go. You know, so am I done? No, you say, I like you. And why is that? It's because most people would say that you would be within your rights to say that I need to trust you again. Right, it's not just that you gave me this back or that I was missing an object for 30 minutes. It's that you broke trust. So why don't you stick around and sweep up the store, help me with something here. Or I want you to meet my family because I want you to know how you would have affected other people. Does that make sense? So that's what's called restorative justice, because you're trying to restore a relationship to where it should be healthy. And in this case, it's a relationship of trust. This also comes from the Jewish law. So I know that Donald Trump just said that his favorite Bible verse is an eye for an eye. and that a lot of us also look at the Jewish law as, oh, that it sounds more like retributive justice, right? Like you cause me pain, I cause you pain. Well, that's not what's going on. This, in Exodus 21, is the first, it's the start of the Jewish laws. It's the first thing that happens after the Ten Commandments. And what that means, my point there is that you have to keep that in mind anytime you read Jewish laws, because what they're saying is, no, this is intended to give the victim some rights to name a compensation, that it's up to the level of an eye for an eye, but it doesn't have to be automatic like that. Does that make sense? So that's the outer limit, proportionality. And this principle has been used in South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the civil wars in Uganda and Rwanda. It's now being used in New Zealand in their juvenile justice system, in Scandinavia's criminal justice system, and other places. It's where the victim has more rights. And this would be way more meaningful. And I'm just going to say, I think we should press for that change. A couple years ago, there was a incident in Dorchester, Mattapan. Two brothers were playing and then fighting. They were 14 and 9. And the 14-year-old had acquired a gun. And out of the heat of anger, he shot his brother and killed him. Now, that, of course, it's a problem. How was he treated? How do you think he should be treated? He was actually tried as an adult, and then I think he was sentenced to many, many years. And you have to ask the question, why? Because who's the victim here? Is that what the family would have really wanted? No. Does that serve the family? Okay, but right, because our criminal justice system is based off of it's based off of a Puritan understanding of a punitive God, and that principle of retribution, of like something happens, if you do something bad should happen to you, like you should suffer, as opposed to give the victim some say about what they need, right? And then have the offender do something to respond to that. Yes, Steve?
It's interesting that you bring that up, because you know, one of the things about Sharia law that's been depicted in some instances in the news also is that the victims and the victims' families have an opportunity to respond and say, I forgive you. And there's this incident in Iran where a victim's mother, instead of having having capital punishment carried out, just slapped the man and said, I forgive you.
That's enough. I just get to slap you. Yeah, I mean, and other cultures have that type of system. So that, yes.
Even the verse that you have up there, actually, verse 17, does imply that there's a penalty.
Yes. 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 By all means. So, but what type of penalty, and who gets to determine that? That's the question. So the fact that this is that is found in the first examples of the eye for an eye language is really important. And I think it's meant to be carried over. So restorative justice doesn't mean that there are no consequences. Oh, there are consequences, but it's just who is empowered to say what the appropriate consequences are? So, and then what are the limits on that? So This is another reason why I think it's fascinating to revisit the Jewish and Christian tradition as a whole on justice and what should we be doing. So this is where, by the way, this is where the basic idea of the 14th Amendment comes from, that everyone should be treated equally under the law. Okay, and you know how that works out. I'm going to explain how that's been eroded. So the first example, and this is on your sheets, and you could read along there or up here with me. And I like this example because it's an example of Asian American activism. Yes. And it's back in 1886. Think back to what it was like in 1886. And you wouldn't think the Supreme Court would be saying these kinds of things. So it's just shocking that actually there was precedent. But essentially, here's the situation. There's a Chinese immigrant named Yik Wo, and he had opened a laundromat in San Francisco. He didn't have a license to do that. And so he was convicted and put in jail, but he appealed. So law enforcement had arrested more than 100 Chinese people for operating laundries without licenses. Here's the problem. San Francisco denied licenses to all Chinese laundry operators. It granted licenses to all other laundry operators but one. So who were the laundry businessmen? White people. That make sense? So this is what the Supreme Court said. Though the law itself be fair on its face, in other words, you know, someone applies for a license, this is what they have to do, and then you give it to them. And then they can set up their business. That's the business law. The law itself be fair on its face and impartial in appearance, yet if it is applied and administered by public authority with an evil eye, I love that phrase, I can't believe it. That's in the Supreme Court ruling, evil eye. And an unequal hand so as practically to make unjust and illegal discriminations between persons in similar circumstances, the denial of equal justice is still within the prohibition of the Constitution. What is that referring to? The 14th Amendment, which was passed in order to protect black people after they were freed from slavery. The 14th, equal protection under the law. Okay, and so the conviction was overturned, he went free, and I assume he just happily set up his laundry business. Isn't that amazing? Yeah. 1886, people. So now, what I'm going to walk you through is, and I'm going to let you read your sheets there, is how that ruling has been completely overturned, so that racial bias is totally okay in the legal system, throughout our criminal justice system. How did that happen? Yes.
So what is the difference between racial bias, blatant racist mentality,
yes,
and then being colorblind, being like an subconscious or an unconscious racial bias that they're not aware of? Because you could tailor this to say that they are specifically targeting the Asians who are immigrating to San Francisco because of the gold rush, right? And they're bringing in opium and their addiction. Or you could say that the government system had a bias or an unconscious bias against minorities. One is blatant, one is subconscious. Both are bad. But
yes.
One is like conscious decision.
Right. Right.
Which one are you going for?
In this case, it's implicit, unspoken. So what you'll see there in the first two cases will explain it. So can we jump in there? And then why don't you come back to me if that hasn't answered the question? Okay, fair enough. So let me give you a few moments to read the next two cases. If you could read the City of Los Angeles case and McCleskey, 1987. So read those two cases, and then let's discuss. Okay. Okay, well, talk to me. What do you think about these cases, and or do you have any questions about them?
So there's no
shows the statistic, though, like for the first case, like how many people and what races they were that were the chokeholds were applied to. So it's hard to say whether 12 out of 16 were black or unproportional.
Right. I don't know the details there, but I think what they were arguing is, number one, there is a stereotype of black men especially being more violent, and so police will police black neighborhoods and then apply more force to black men especially. And so when we see there that, okay, out of the 16, 12 were black, that is part of the question, right, and the problem of, look, you know, is this being applied fairly? And is this something that even should be applied?
Yeah, I think the police, those, you know, white police probably feel a lot more threatened by black people because they, maybe, I don't know, bigger or whatever. So they probably responded or even reacted differently. I mean, if I walk down Chinatown, whether it's a Chinese person coming towards me, a white male or a black male, I probably would have a different physical reaction when they approach me.
Sure. However, a lot of that is context dependent and media dependent. Like, what have you seen most recently about each of these people?
Yeah.
And so part of the, if you go to, if you Google Harvard implicit racial bias test and take that test, it will be very revealing. And I think that what happens is also been studied. Basically, it measures the amount of racial bias that you have implicitly without saying anything, right? So there's an association of, okay, white or black with bad or good or vice, you know, so, and then the originator of that test actually tests himself every day. And because he's aware, he's a white man, and he's aware that he has racial bias. And so he's always interested in how much bias he's carrying. And there was one time where he actually demonstrated a very favorable opinion of the images of black people. And he was like, that's not my usual result. And why did I just test that way? And what he realized was that morning he had seen something very positive about professionals that were black. So doctors, lawyers, business people, you know, activists and so on. And so that day he had a very positive association, right? Because our minds look for basic patterns, and race is one of the patterns that our minds cue in on, whether you wanted to or not. And so the issue of implicit bias is very dependent on what kind of TV have you been watching? What kind of movies? How has the news been filtered? Like, if you watch Fox News, what do they report on? Things that would make you afraid. They do. That's been documented. That's been studied. So why? And that's a whole nother thing. But if you go around looking for that kind of news, you will probably absorb, just because of the air we breathe and because the U.S. is founded on the idea and still on some level holds the idea of white supremacy. So it is implicit bias can act in very, very pervasive ways.
Yeah.
So the point of these things are to say, you know, like the police are not, no one is, or very few people are saying, well, it's because he's black that I applied the chokehold.
Right.
No, it's because I was afraid, and so I applied the chokehold. But then, what's driving the fear? Steve, did you have a comment?
I'm trying to figure out from this one. It says that this man alliance did not have the standing and challenge to LAPD practice. So it talks about the the summary talks about the dissenting view, but what was the substance of the majority view that you did not have standing to challenge LGBT practice? I guess that's kind of essential in terms of figuring out, like, aside from the practice in the Supreme Court, do we also see sort of implicit bias as well? So my question is, what was the majority opinion? How did they justify this?
I believe it was that law enforcement has to kind of do what's necessary. And this is just one of the tools that's sometimes necessary. And so it is, if you wanted to handle it, you have to take it up directly with the police, but that it wasn't an issue of constitutional law. So it was basically, well, I mean, on some level, there would have to be new legislation passed that says you can't do it this way. The point of this, bringing it up in this context, is to say when police are able to apply these kinds of measures to folks, who do we think is going to be more disproportionately affected?
Black people.
Absolutely. And so, you know, Eric Garner's case of the I can't breathe. Well, I mean, this is exactly that case.
But why weren't the police thoroughly trained? Because they were not told that, that bar arm control can cause death if applied for just 2 seconds. This is like...
Right. Now, I don't know all the reasons for it, but what is true is that during the 70s and 80s and early 90s, there was a very strong fear of crime in the United States. Part of that, actually, is because of lead poisoning is what we're starting to realize. Because of... you know what's happened in Flint, Michigan, with the lead being in the water. We have also realized, and 9 other countries have realized, that when they essentially changed from leaded gasoline to unleaded gasoline, that the crime rate goes down because lead makes you crazy. And so this perfectly corresponds with the crime wave in the United States. So this is really important. But police at that time, and a lot of public officials and the public in general, was very afraid of crime. And so these police tactics developed in that context.
Yeah, but they were not told that those things were legal then, or fatal. Then how could they be held accountable?
Well, that's a good point. I don't know the inner workings of the police. But it's a great point.
I don't know, but at the same point, though, like, as a human being, like, wouldn't you know that you're, like, I don't know, if I were putting someone in the chokehold, like, I could tell that, like, they were in danger. Like, you, common sense would tell you, like, don't do it too long, right? Like, just...
I don't know.
I'm
not sure. Right, because when If you felt that your life was threatened as a police officer, I mean, that's not a moment where you yourself are thinking the most clearly either. And so on some level, you can understand why that might happen. But you're right. I mean, as a matter of policy, why weren't they told this? Why aren't they trained in other methods of restraint or de-escalating a situation? How come our police are not trained in martial arts? I don't know.
They were all those choking.
Right, right. Well, yes. So,
I guess my point is that just because you're told something doesn't mean you follow it blindly. That's what I'm trying to say.
Nobody needs to know.
Right. The situation here is that most didn't know. Right, they weren't even trained. It's one thing if you wanted to hold a police officer accountable for something they were actually trained to do, or trained to avoid, then that's one thing. But then this is a whole system that's not actually educating the police officers in the what we think are the most appropriate ways of restraint. So, So, you know, a lot of what Black Lives Matter, the movement, is trying to get our attention is focused on this kind of stuff, right? It's the over-policing of black communities. It's the over-restraining of black individuals. So this is where it comes from. The second case, anyone have thoughts on the second case, McCleskey versus Kemp?
It's interesting. I Googled this case.
Yep.
They don't have the jurors' information. Not names, but just demographics. So what was the proportion between a white, you know, within that jury? How much of it was white? How much of it was a minority?
Oh, the jury.
Yes.
These are Supreme Court cases.
You mean the nine Supreme Court justices?
No. The jury decided that he should be sentenced to death.
Right.
And then two life consecutive terms for the robbery, according to one of the law school websites. That was the case.
The original jury, right. Yeah.
The original jury. But they never talked about the bias of the jury. I can't find it online. So what, like, how do we make their case?
If you wanted to look on the second page and read Perkett versus Elm in that particular thing, I'll just summarize it. Basically, it's that jury selection is biased. So, and I may not have to, I wasn't planning on covering that, but you could read it in your spare time. Yes, Anna.
In addition to the jury selections, with the defense attorney for this case, are they public counsel? Or privately engaged? Are the defense attorney black?
That's a great question. I don't know. Do you think that matters?
Oh, it matters.
How does it matter?
I see it matters in court.
Because the prosecution, whether they sympathize with or the, you know, their client and things like that, the defense attorney?
And many other factors.
Yeah. We'll get into that on the next case, Armstrong v. United States, because that has to do with prosecution. But before we go there, basically what McCleskey versus Kemp is saying is that sentencing could be, we admit it is racially biased in an implicit way, but not in an explicit way. So as long as a jury does not say, well, he's black or brown, therefore we're going to give him or her the death penalty, then it's okay. As long as they avoid saying that it's because of this person's race that we're giving this higher sentence, then actually that higher sentence is okay. It can't be challenged. Okay, that's the principle here. So again, we are moving away from what? The 14th Amendment, equal justice under the law, and Yickwo v. Hopkins, which reaffirmed that. Okay, and this is the different stages of the criminal justice process. So policing to prosecution to sentencing to jury selection. So now let's look at prosecution. Okay, if you could read Armstrong v. U.S., one note that I want to make on this basically is that, I'll just read it. Christopher Lee Armstrong was arrested for possession of and conspiracy to distribute 50 grams of crack cocaine. Now, when you are arrested and you deal with the prosecutor and your defense attorney, they decide whether to send you to the federal system, which is more strict on drug issues, or the state system, which is not as strict, and there's more a little more discretion given to, and so essentially that's the situation here. So his federal public defenders were troubled that in the last 3 years, 48 defendants had been black, 5 were Hispanic, and none were white. Given that most crack offenders are white, they were puzzled. They suspected that whites were being diverted by federal prosecutors to the state system, where penalties for crack cocaine were far less severe. Armstrong's lawyers filed a motion asking the prosecutors to turn over their files to support their claim of selective prosecution under the 14th Amendment. As in McCleskey, the court did not question the accuracy of the evidence submitted, but ruled that because Armstrong failed to identify any similarly situated white defendants who should have been charged in federal court but were not, he was not entitled even to discovery or the inquiry in the investigation on his selective prosecution claim. With no trace of irony, the court demanded that Armstrong produce in advance the very thing he sought in discovery. Information regarding white defendants who should have been charged in federal court. The court justified this insurmountable hurdle on the grounds that considerable deference is owed the exercise of the prosecutorial discretion. Unless evidence of conscious, intentional bias on the part of the prosecutor could be produced, the court would not allow any inquiry into the reasons for or causes of apparent racial disparities in prosecutorial decision-making. So as long as if the prosecutor says, you know, I'm racist, and so I'm sending black and brown people to the federal system, I'm going to send white and Asian people to the state system. Like, okay, that would get the prosecutor in trouble. But as long as he doesn't say anything, he could do that all day long. Does that seem fair to you?
Who would admit that?
Exactly. I mean, we're all smart enough to not say, I'm racist. So how is it that this is fair? So Michelle Alexander goes on to say, the courthouse doors were closed. The court gave prosecutors full discretion to have unspoken, implicit racial bias. This reversed Yickwo v. Hopkins. Racially selective enforcement was now accepted. Consequently, a report in 2000 observed that among youth who had never been sent to a juvenile prison before, African Americans were more than six times as likely as whites to be sentenced to prison for identical crimes. A study sponsored by the U.S. Justice Department and several of the nation's leading foundations published in 2007 found that the impact of biased treatment is magnified with each additional step into the criminal justice system. Wow. Wow. I'm just going to summarize Perkett v. Elm. Basically, this is about jury selection. Now, how many of you would prefer to if you ever committed a crime and you were up on trial and you faced a jury, how many of you would prefer a jury of people who looked like you? You're probably right. I mean, because they're more likely to be sympathetic, to at least understand the circumstances that may have brought about your decision. So this story goes that essentially it's okay to, the Supreme Court said, it's okay to exclude black jurors on the basis of their hair, of their facial hair, of kind of the way they look. And already, for anyone who has been to prison, it says 30% of black men are already ineligible for jury service for life because of the legal status attributed to their criminal background. So does that make sense? So if you're African American, then the chances that you will face a jury of your actual peers is really, really small. And the prosecutors can select a jury that will be totally, totally against you, or at least not sympathetic. Yeah, that's our justice system. So again, from policing to prosecution to sentencing to jury selection, it's okay to be racist as long as you don't say that you are. And these are Supreme Court cases. Isn't that amazing? I mean, is that astounding to you? So the 14th Amendment was founded on a biblical principle. Everyone's equal. Everyone deserves the same treatment under the law. Is that still important? I kind of think so. But we have made it okay to not do that. So this is the probably the most challenging aspect of the war on drugs, which is that we have full-on admissions that the war on drugs was never really about drugs. It was really about black people and hippies who were opposing the Vietnam War. And what it goes on, right, because in the 80s, Ronald Reagan campaigned, basically gone on a get tough on crime rhetoric, and that's what's called dog whistle politics. You know, dogs can hear whistles that humans can't hear. The idea is that certain words mean something to people who are trying to listen for it. So, you know, what does states' rights mean? Well, if you live in the South and you're black, states' rights means preventing the federal government from interfering in white supremacy. That's what it means. Right? So who campaigns on that? Well, Reagan did. And then I don't mean to just blame Republicans, because Bill Clinton passed a very tough crime bill in 1994, and that included the mandatory minimums and the three strikes laws. Basically, if you do three felonies, then you get a really, really severe sentence, because it basically, you know, we write you off. We don't think you're worth the investment anymore as a society, right? And so, boy, that was really tough. And again, if you look back on the Jewish law, do you ever write off a person? No, there's nothing like that. You have to handle every action separately. So the three strikes law is not only immoral and ungodly, it's unconstitutional because of cruel and unusual punishment means that it must be proportional to the crime you commit, not how many crimes you commit. Because do we think that we paid for crime, that you paid for your crimes? So the Supreme Court case that went up challenging the three strikes law was this one. There was a guy who was basically, his third felony was this. He walked into a store and stole VHS videotapes worth about $122 around Christmas that he was going to give to his kids. He was about 40 years old. Okay, at age 27, he had committed a robbery. And at age 17, he had, as a juvenile, committed a robbery. So that was felony number three.
Yeah, how could that be felony?
Felony number three, because it was theft worth $122. And he was given a sentence of 50 years. Normally, judges would have the discretion, right, to say, hey, I see you here. I see a bunch of people from your church, from your community, from your family who are gathered here to be with you. I hear that you're a decent guy in other ways. And so I'm going to give you a sentence of community service and a fine. Right? Judges used to have that kind of discretion. Now they do not, because of something called mandatory minimums. Basically, we have taken away judges' discretion to make those kinds of decisions. So it's up to the prosecutor. Does any of this sound fair? I mean, it's just crazy. Because in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, there was a hysteria about crime, and we didn't know the root causes. Now we're pretty sure that it was actually lead poisoning. And it was also, there were racial sentiments fanned into flame by U.S. politics. And Donald Trump is kind of actually playing off that. That has continued, if you've noticed. You know, the growth of hate groups over the last few months is actually surprising. So this is the situation, okay? So I hope I have persuaded you that there is a problem. This is the impact of mandatory minimums. This comes from a story cited by Michelle Alexander. I did a little bit more research, and this is from Frontline. Where is it? Anyway, I'll read it to you. On November 2nd, 2000, Irma Faye Stewart, then 30, and a single mother of two, and Regina Kelly, then 24, and a single mother of four, were arrested as part of a major drug sweep in Hearne, Texas. As reported by Frontline, the 27 individuals arrested in the sweep was indicted by a single informant later proven to be unreliable. All but one of the 27 are African-American. Both women proclaimed their innocence and were given public defenders who offered them little guidance and insisted that they plead guilty. Stewart's lawyer reported not remembering Stewart despite signing her plea agreement. By the way, that's not completely surprising to me. I have a friend who works as a defendant, a public defendant for the city of Boston. You know, he gets paid less than I do, and I'm a campus minister. About $40,000. Totally overworked. So I could understand how this happens. Stewart's lawyer reported not remembering. Kelly and Stewart were both told that if they did not agree to a plea bargain, which amounted to probation, they would face 5 to 99 years. With a bail of $70,000 and two small children at home, Stewart took the deal and was sentenced to 10 years probation. But after a 5-month wait for the trial to begin, the state's case fell apart. Everyone that didn't take a plea bargain, including Kelly, was found not guilty. Stewart, on the other hand, fell into destitution because of the plea bargain. Unable to secure food stamps or federal education money, unable to vote, evicted from public housing. Okay, why? Because once you have a felony on your record, you are no longer eligible for any of these things. Okay, if you're a conservative on these issues, then here's my challenge to you. If I get out of prison and I want to get back with my wife and children and she's on public assistance, then you've just created an economic disincentive for us to reunite as a family. How could that be? We're supposed to be family friendly. And forced to pay a $1,000 fine and count fees on a minimum wage salary. Kelly and Stewart's stories are far from isolated incidents. In the United States, almost 95% of all felony convictions are secured without a jury. That's the Eighth Amendment, folks. People who really have no idea what their legal rights are being pressured by this mandatory minimum of, hey, you could get 5 to 99 years. You better plead guilty to something like the lesser crime. There a unique facet of American law that allows the prosecutor to offer a reduced sentence in exchange for defendants waiving their rights to a jury trial and pleading guilty to the charges presented. Wow. You know, what's happened is that the police have rounded up too many people for the jury system to actually handle. We have a big, the criminal justice system has an enormous mouth. Its digestive system is really narrow, right? Like, and it just can't handle this. So that's why we've developed these methods. Now, I want to go to scripture again and reflect on this. Again, I'm going to compare the Jewish system, which we inherit as Christians, and then the comparison points. Okay, so first, the Jewish system. This is where we get the idea of innocent until proven guilty. This comes from the leading chief rabbi of South Africa. Jewish law has never authorized judicial torture. Let me back up, actually. Torture in the ancient world was applied to, was used to people already accused of a crime because they thought, we don't think you're reliable, so we're going to torture you to make sure that your confession is truthful. That makes a lot of sense, right? No, it doesn't. It's because there's a presumption of guilty until proven innocent. So, and I'll read you a few things about that, but keep that in mind. In fact, judicial torture of an accused would serve no purpose in Jewish law because even voluntary confessions are inadmissible as evidence. Inadmissible. So I say I'm guilty of a crime. Actually, Jewish law would say we can't take your word for it. Because of the two witnesses requirement of Deuteronomy. Jewish law's rejection of judicial torture is unique in Western civilization, especially because it is so ancient. The law against self-incrimination relates to the accused's vulnerability. Is this the Fifth Amendment? Yeah. Right, I plead the Fifth. It's like, look, I'm not going to say anything. You can't get me to say anything. So this is where it comes from. Now, here is ancient Greece. In the 4th century BC, Aristotle listed 5 different ways to prove guilt that may be used in legal proceedings, and he included torture among them. In general, torture was used by the Greeks only when it came to the testimony of slaves. Why? Because slaves are unreliable. And in certain situations, foreigners. Then Rome expands on that. Early Roman law, similar to Greek law, in that it also limited torture to slaves. The institution of torture was eventually expanded to include freemen. Between the 2nd and 4th centuries, the institution was expanded to include new types of people and situations. The various emperors had the power to authorize torture for new cases and were responsible for expanding the institution of torture in Roman law. This comes back into pre-modern and modern Europe. By the 16th century, a substantially similar law of torture was in force from the Sicily to Scandinavia, from Spain or Iberia across France and the German Empire to the Slavic East. Well into the 18th century, the law of torture was still current everywhere, and it survived into the 19th century in some corners of Europe and also England. Again, so on the one hand, you have ancient Greece, Rome, and Europe in England. On the other hand, you have Jewish law, which says Jewish law's rejection of judicial torture is unique in Western civilization, especially because it is so ancient. Dang, who thought up this stuff? Innocent until proven guilty. Why? Because there's a bias in Jewish law towards protecting the vulnerable, at least until it's clear that they are guilty, right? So why is that? Because once you accuse someone of a crime, what happens in the human mind? You make that other person an other. Like somehow, and then you accuse, and the more distant you make them from you, the less you personally identify with them, the steeper the punishments are that you're likely to give. And this is probably a reflection on Adam blaming Eve, right? Like, this woman you gave me, she made me sin. Right, right. And so there is an effort to restrain that. And this is really where the Fifth Amendment comes from. Again, I want to call your attention. These are the reasons why, even though young people in the black community and young people in the white community, either the drug use is higher in the white community than in the black community, right? Like, and yet, what is our stereotype? What does the media present to us? Why are our prisons overflowing with black and brown people? How come the police don't come to white fraternities looking for drugs? Or helicopter into white mansions where you know they're having drug parties? Why is it inner cities? Because police just have to fill a quota. Sometimes they actually get to keep the things that they possess, and they know that folks of color, especially poor people, are going to have a harder time challenging them. And now we have just made implicit racial bias okay throughout the entire justice system through 4 major Supreme Court decisions. What happened to Yickwo v. Hopkins? What happened to the 14th Amendment? We do not have equal treatment under the law. And that is an issue of procedural justice. Right? So many of you, if you know me, you know that I'm pretty big on economic justice. This isn't an issue of economic justice. This is an issue of procedural justice. It's how you get processed by the criminal justice system. So actually, everyone should be able to agree that this is a problem, because people aren't being treated fairly. And this is actually why folks on the right and folks on the left agree that we need to repeal the war on drugs and really revisit this issue. Not only are we going bankrupt because our prisons are overflowing, we just can't handle it, but we're learning that it's grossly unfair. Okay, so here are some action steps. So if you wanted to take down these websites, these are great organizations that I've actually used and I encourage other people to use to write your congressperson. So probably you all are, I assume, Massachusetts residents, although maybe your state of residence is elsewhere. But you can look up, okay, where are we as Massachusetts on things like mandatory minimums, three strikes laws, and things like that. There's a strong movement to repeal that. And last summer, you know, I wrote to our congresspeople and said, please, please keep at it. This is how our system works, and this is how I think we have to think of a Christian use of power on behalf of the vulnerable and on behalf of people who are treated unjustly. We have to take it seriously. So drug policy action is another, and they will educate you on a whole bunch of other aspects of the criminal justice system and the policing system as well. And again, if you are interested in a 5 to 7 week small group experience, I've designed this new Jim Crow curriculum for my church, and I've used it also with college students. Some folks that I have hired to work with me have also used it at Duke and at Princeton. So it's been at BC, Harvard, Tufts. It's been really effective. And I'll just say, from a church perspective, when we did this last summer and we discussed this and we took actions, new people came to visit my small group every week. Why? Because there are lots of people who already recognize this as a problem. And so I had folks who are not Christians visiting my new people almost every week. And that's why I've chosen to handle Scripture in a way that compares it to other, you know, sources that are meaningful, because then we could get a better perspective of what's going on here. Right, and in the end, you know, basically, we come to look at Jesus as the liberator. When Jesus started his ministry in Nazareth, he said, "I have come to set the captives free." Now, what he was referring to is our captivity to our own sinfulness, but in order to get that message across, he would liberate people from disease, from demonic possession, and from other things. And so I really think that this is a really good way to weave two things together. Social justice in this aspect is really restoring the captives. It's helping people who, especially for nonviolent drug offenders, come out from prison and really start a new life and be restored to the persons that God always had in mind, the people that God wanted them to be. But it takes help. It takes a community to embrace them and be for them. It really does. And so as we talk about Jesus as the one who restores us to who we were meant to be, who God always meant for us to be, I think as we do that for others in a lesser way, I think the world around us, our neighbors, our classmates, our workmates, will actually take us a little bit more seriously. Any questions?
Who is Jim Crow? I don't even know the existing Jim Crow along with you.
Well, the old, does anyone know?
The African American man that was lynched to death.
Hung on a tree, and essentially it became a name applied to racial segregation from the post-Civil War period. Yeah.
Yeah, actually,
actually, you're right. It's really, in some sense, very unfair. I think the white people, if they're drug addicts, they're being treated as like medical patients.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. And so because of opioid addiction and heroin these days, people are saying, well, you know, those are our kids, right? Because before they weren't our kids, they were someone else's kids. And so there's more of a restorative framework rather than a retributive framework. You know, let's take this seriously, but let's get them help. Let's put them into counseling programs, detox programs, whatever they need in order to stay free.
And they never mention about this even illegal.
Absolutely.
They're to buy the stuff, they know who they are, and then they're never arrested. They
yep.
Into whatever prestigious institutions.
Right. So, on the one hand, I think that's good that we're finally getting to recognize that self-harm is not something, you know, that we can that is best treated as a criminal offense. It's a medical problem, and it's a public health issue. You know, it's more, I think drug use is more in the category of suicide. Like, if someone attempts suicide, does it make a lot of sense to criminalize it and throw the person in jail? No, it makes more sense to hospitalize that person and just put resources, give that person resources. Self-harm is more like, now drug selling and drug dealing is other harm, in my opinion. And so I think we still need to take that seriously. But drug possession and drug use, I think we really need to treat that differently. And other countries have. Sweden, Switzerland, and Portugal have really have changed in the last 10 years on how they treat drug use. And so they've legalized it, but they regulate it, right? So young people and, you know, can't, because of our brain formation is critical at certain, you know, when we're young. And then, but I think getting dispensaries where it's legal, I forget which country does this, but essentially they give free needles. And then you could actually use, I think it's heroin, there at the station, at the dispensary. If you try to use it outside, it's illegal, and there's some kind of fine, but it's legal there. But what that does is it makes it, it takes it away from parties. So you can't use it in parties, which make drugs sexy. You have to go to this place, which is actually pretty depressing, but you'll get a clean needle, you won't get AIDS, and the idea is we really want to we don't actually want you to do this. Given that you're probably going to do this elsewhere, we'll at least make this place clean, but we really want to get you some help, but we need you to choose it. And people really need to buy in. And they have seen drug use drop. So if we look at it from a public health standpoint or a restorative standpoint, it's much more effective. It's also it's cheaper.
Yeah, I think this country is doing that, but only to the white people.
Yeah, and we need to make sure that it is balanced, because crack cocaine versus powder cocaine, there were stereotypes of black people use crack cocaine and white people use powder cocaine. And so prior to 2010, crack cocaine got punished 100 times more severely than powder cocaine. 100 times. Now, Obama changed that so that it's 18 times. I don't know enough exactly of why that is, right? That still seems weird to me. But we need to watch things like that, because, as we have seen, drug use is always a stereotyped thing. When we say drug users, most people have someone in mind.
Mother of two white women.
Yeah, yeah. Now that there is over-the-counter drugs that are legal. Steve, you had a question, and then...
I had another question, and then something that related to what you just said about drug use. And so I'll go to the second one first, which is, so with drug use, you know, one of the ways that we teach our children to avoid drugs is, in some ways, stigmatize drug use, right?
Yeah.
So if you stigmatize drug use, and you stigmatize people who use drugs, you know, sort of as a tactic, that is going to carry over into societal attitudes and into law enforcement, all that stuff. So how do you basically, how are you still able to teach your children not to use drugs without that big carryover effect of spilling into how we treat folks in society and can live there?
That's a great question. I can only speak as a parent and not a policymaker on this one because I'm not sure. So I have two kids, 13 and 15. Thankfully, they have not used drugs. But part of it is that my dad was an alcoholic. So when they think about alcohol, they're thinking of someone in their family. Does that make sense? So that should be pretty easy, right? Because drug use does not discriminate, actually, among races. There should be someone who looks like your kids that has used drugs. And I would think that that's the most natural place to start. It really doesn't make sense. And I think it's an ethical problem to point to some other race and say, well, don't be like them, because you're conflating two different things.
And so the second one was, as the Social Responsibility Committee, who hosted this emphasis weekend, we're trying to figure out, like, what are good next steps in terms of for us? And you've already written down some great action steps there: get educated and also exercise the political power, which is great. Now, also, I guess in addition to education and exercising political power, in the realm of, you know, compassion and mercy ministry, what have you seen churches do, I guess, and particularly things that are relevant for an Asian American church? What are some, you know, mercy steps that people can take?
Some important steps would be, visit the website called Center for Church and Prison. It's actually here in Boston. It's a really neat initiative, and essentially, whether as individuals or as congregations, there are some important steps. A lot of it has to do with prisoner reintegration. And if you like his humor, John Oliver, the comedian, has really good segments on all the criminal justice section, but especially reentry. So you could talk about that. I know folks over at, friends of mine at CCFC in Cambridge, have committed to there are a few people who own their own businesses and for whom it is appropriate to look at folks who are coming out of prison. So, because employment for folks is probably the biggest deal. I don't know how much we can influence this, but housing and eligibility for public housing and food stamps and things like that, that seems like it's changing. The HUD, the health... Housing and Urban Development Department just recently said they're going to look into the denial of benefits or public housing opportunities as unconstitutional or it violates the Fair Housing Act of 1968. So there was a really good article on that. But essentially, you want to be really sensitive to that kind of thing. There's a Ban the Box campaign. I didn't put that up here because Boston has already made headway on that. But if you have friends in other cities or states that have not done that, the Ban the Box is the employment box that says, like, I have a felony record. And so Obama banned the box for federal positions. But I do think that's meaningful. It will come into play. It still allows employers to check at some point, right? Because if you're a person hiring for a role that cares for children, then you probably want to know, and that's probably relevant. But the issue is that it's been used to deny people barber's licenses, landscaping, gardening licenses. I mean, things that you would not think it really matters. So that's why that effort is there. And then check out these things. But the Center for Church and Prison is another one. I'm sorry I didn't put that up here.